You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. The September celebration of Labor Day is a purely American phenomenon and has its roots in a celebration of labor established by the New York City's Central Labor Council in 1882. It was the date chosen by the government when Labor Day was made a federal holiday in 1894. Throughout most of the world, however, working people celebrate on May 1st to commemorate the 1886 police attack against a rally of workers in Chicago's Haymarket Square who were fighting for the 8-hour day and protesting police repression of the labor movement. Chicago historian Chris Mahan takes Mike Thornton of People's Tribune Radio on a guided tour of the site of the Haymarket Massacre.
Here we are at the corner of Randolph and Des Plaines, and there aren't any really obvious markings, if you look around, to commemorate a very, very famous place in the history not only of the United States, but of the world. On the night of Tuesday, May 4th, 1886, there was a protest meeting here, and that protest meeting was broken up by the police, and out of that, labor leaders were placed on trial. Some of them were subsequently executed, and then out of that came the May Day holiday that, while it's not that well known in the United States, is commemorated as Labor Day virtually throughout the world. In the 1880s, Chicago was the fastest growing city in the world. And so this city was a city in which factories were booming, people were coming into this city from all over the world, but yet there were terrible conditions in the factories. People had to work many, many hours, and the conditions were unsafe. And as a result of that, you had two different motions that were going on. One, you had a general national motion to get an 8-hour day, and then you also had specific fights in specific industries and factories. Now, to set this scene for May 4th, what happened on May 4th, on May 1st of 1886, there was a gigantic demonstration on Michigan Avenue to demand the 8-hour day. That was part of a general series of demonstrations throughout the United States. But on May 3rd, there was an incident of police brutality at the McCormick Reaper plant. And there was a decision by a number of labor leaders to call a meeting for the next night.
Chris Mahan talks about how the Chicago fire impacted the events at Haymarket Square.
You had this terrible, terrible tragedy. You had the poorest section of the population, as always happens in these sorts of tragedies, earthquakes in California or in Nicaragua or wherever, it's the poor who suffer the most. But then when the world responds and sends its relief supplies and its donations to these charitable committees, as has happened in other instances, that money doesn't necessarily trickle down to the poorest section of the population. There was even a situation where businessmen would borrow money from the relief funds without any interest. And out of that began the first efforts for the organization of the working class, some of the first efforts for the organization of the working class in Chicago, where people started demanding that they be helped, the people who needed it the most. And some of the leaders who emerged in the Haymarket era first began their social activity, their activity on behalf of the poor and the working class population as a result of the Chicago Fire of 1871. So now we're standing at the spot here of what's known as Crane's Alley. It was right here where there was a wagon that was set up. Okay, there's, you can imagine there was this square just a few feet from us. We've walked just a little bit north from where we were just a moment ago. And at this spot, at this alley, there was a wagon. And on that wagon, various speakers were speaking, various leaders of the union movement in Chicago at that time. And a number of them were foreign-born workers, August Spies, other leaders of the union movement. Now, and the fight for the 8-hour day. Now, what happened was that this movement, or this rally, started at about 8:30. Originally, there was 2,500 people at the rally. The rally received a permit from the mayor. The mayor actually came to this spot and listened to some of the speeches. But what happened was that this was a rally that had been called on one day's notice. And it was actually a little bit disorganized. And so people began to drift away, as sometimes happens. Some of the speeches were a little bit long. And so by about 10:30, there was a speaker, Samuel Fielden, who was a very, very decent man. He was a working class man who had emigrated from England. His family had been involved in supporting the Union during the American Civil War, you know, part of that section of the British population that stood with the Union. But he was actually a bit of a dull speaker. He was speaking, people were starting to drift away, and at that point, 76 actually, to be absolutely precise, police officers marched up from the area that's now behind us, and they began to break up the meeting. And Samuel Fielden said to the officer who insisted that they disperse, "But officer, we are peaceable." And he began to descend from the wagon. At that point, someone in the crowd, or someone, threw a bomb. At that point, the police began firing. The bomb killed several people. The police then began firing, and they killed a number of people, including a number of police officers, and wounded a number of others. And then basically a reign of terror broke out in the city of Chicago, where the police went around and basically just did away with freedom of speech in this city. I mean, they broke into union halls, they broke into immigrant societies, they broke into socialist and anarchist organizations' offices, and arrested anyone who they thought might have some connection with the incident. And they arrested several leaders of the union movement and the revolutionary movement of that time and charged them with conspiracy. We're actually stepping into the alley right now as I speak. The bomb, it was thrown northward towards the wagon. I think one of the things that's significant is that this incredible incident, this incident which is recorded in so many history books around the world and which is marked by gigantic Labor Day demonstrations in Paris and Mexico City and cities all over the world, I'm going to show you the complete extent of its commemoration by the city of Chicago. We are coming up to it right now, so let's just walk over there now. We're walking through the alley, and we come to the sidewalk. And in the sidewalk, next to some weeds on a chain fence, is a very small plaque. And this is the grand total of the commemoration by the city of Chicago of this historic incident. And it took considerable struggle by the trade union movement, by the labor historians of this city, by decent people of the city, to even get this. And I think this shows how dangerous this history is to the powers that be in the United States. So I'd just like to read the plaque.
It's really amazing, Chris, in the fact that we just rode on the L train past the United Center, which, of course, as you were pointing out to me, was built on the site that at one time was public housing and was torn down to build this monument to professional sports, where there's a huge statue of Michael Jordan in front of the stadium. And here we are in Haymarket Square, and, you know, truth be told, I mean, this is incredible how paltry this is. I mean, I really wish people could see this because, I mean, it is, on some level, without discounting the work that the people put in to get this, I mean, it's really on some level almost insulting to the memory of the place.
I would agree. And if, let me just read it here, so that our listeners get a sense of it. It says, Chicago Landmark, site of the Haymarket Tragedy, 1886. And I can actually just barely read this. This is how paltry it is. But it says, a decade of strife between labor and industry culminated here in a confrontation that resulted in the something death, I can barely read this, of tragic death of both workers and policemen on May 4th, 1886, spectators at a labor rally had gathered around the mouth of nearby Crane's Alley. A contingent of police approaching on Desplaines Street were met by a bomb thrown from just south of the alley The resultant trial of 8 activists gained worldwide attention for the labor movement and initiated the tradition of May Day labor rallies in many cities. Designated on March 25, 1992, Richard M. Daley, Mayor, Commission on Chicago Landmarks.
And of course, as we almost get run over by a garbage truck backing into the alley.
You notice it says designated on March 25th, 1992.
Professor Howard Zinn is the author of The People's History of the United States. In October 1998, he spoke to the United Food and Commercial Workers Union in Denver, Colorado, about the need for a working-class citizen's economic bill of rights. Howard Zinn.
I sort of feel there's not a lot I can tell this group, because I look around and I see veteran organizers, and people been working in the trade union movement, people on picket lines. Am I romanticizing? Am I exaggerating? That's what you look like to me. Hardened veterans of the labor movement. So I'll try not to talk too long, right? If I'm going to say things you already know, I may as well keep it short. And then we can have a discussion. You can ask questions, and I can answer anything, of course. And we'll take it from there. I said I would talk about an economic bill of rights, which seems like a good thing to talk about. Everybody knows we have a political bill of rights. And it's interesting that, you know, you go to school and you learn, you know, one of the great things about our democracy and the political structure in the United States and the Constitution is that we have a Bill of Rights. And I know it never occurred to me as I was learning this in school, and I don't think it occurs to most people who learn about the Bill of Rights. It never occurs to them and to us to think this Bill of Rights deals with political rights. It deals with the right of free speech and press and assembly and religion. It deals with the right to counsel and the right to trial by jury and all sorts of things like that. You know, the right against double jeopardy and the right not to testify against yourself. And all of these are sort of judicial, civil liberties, political rights. And it never occurred to me to ask, how come there is nothing in the Bill of Rights which guarantees people the right to live? the right to health, the right to medical care. Why aren't people guaranteed the right to jobs if they want to work? Why aren't people guaranteed the right to decent housing, to care for their children? I mean, these would seem to be even more important than the right to trial by jury, as a small number of us may come before juries. Well, people like the ones in this room might be the kind of people who... But most people don't come before juries. But everybody has a problem of taking care of their health and of getting work and of making a decent wage. None of those things are in the Bill of Rights. But I guess it was also at a certain point that it occurred to me that even the political rights, which we are presumably guaranteed, don't mean very much without economic democracy. That is, for instance, the right of free speech. And on its face, it seems wonderful. Everybody has the right of free speech. And then when you begin to look into it, of course, you learn that there are little footnotes and considerations that make the right of free speech not as absolute as you think it is when you first read it in the Bill of Rights. I mean, of course, one of the things you learn is that your right of free speech is only guaranteed against governmental interference and not against private interference. So that private corporations can interfere with your right of free speech and you have no constitutional right to challenge that. And then for a very long time until this century, even the right of free speech guaranteed against government only applied against the federal government, which meant that state governments could deprive you of freedom of speech up to the hilt, and you had no constitutional protection against that. And then, of course, when you think about the relationship between wealth and the Bill of Rights and the First Amendment of right to freedom of speech, and at a certain point in your life, it occurs to you that Yes, we all have the right of free speech, but some of us have more of a right than others. That is, some of us have a right to reach millions of people and speak freely to these millions of people, and others of us have the right to speak to 50 people or 100 people. And I remember, I remember when we were kids, they said, well, anybody, this is what makes this a wonderful country, anybody can get up on a soapbox in Union Square. I don't know why they always picked on Union Square, but anybody in New York, anybody can get up on a soapbox in Union Square and say whatever he wants. Well, yes, you can get up on a soapbox and 50 people will hear you. But if you manufactured the soapbox, if you were Procter & Gamble, you could go on the air and reach a million people. And so freedom of speech is not just a quantitative, it's not just a qualitative thing, it's a quantitative thing. It's not just a matter of do you have free speech, it's a matter of how much free speech do you have. And then if you go down the list of other items, of course, in the political Bill of Rights, and you ask, and you begin to think about how the distribution of wealth affects those, it's very startling to think that all of these so-called beautiful rights are all hedged in by the problem of economic injustice. And although everybody has the right to counsel, some people have the right to $1 million counsel, and other people have the right to a state-appointed counsel. I remember one time my students, I taught a course for years called Law and Justice in America. And the theme of the course, which could be summed up in one sentence, which students only had to attend the first 5 minutes of the course, then they could go home, was that there's a difference between law and justice. Now, difference between what the Constitution says on paper and what your rights are in reality. I remember some of my students, because my students, I'd always, instead of giving them exams, I'd have them go out into the city and explore things and write about what they saw, issues of law and justice. And I remember a number of my students went to court, and they watched the court-appointed attorneys, when the court-appointed attorneys were meeting with their clients, the clients for whom they had just been appointed. And, right, the court-appointed attorney is appointed a client who is accused of a crime, goes over to the client, says, come out into the corridor with me, go out into the corridor, and my students timed the amount of time spent with a client before going in to argue the case. And the average time was 7 minutes. And I suppose part of the reason for not questioning this is that we don't like in this country, in the dominant culture, and that means in the educational system, and that means in the media, we don't really like to face the fact that we are a class society. Yes, Brazil, that's a class society. But not the United States of America. We the people of the United States got together and formed this Constitution. All of us together, the founding fathers and us, all of us got together, as if the founding fathers, were a multicultural group, And there's this assumption that there is a unity of interest in this country. And the language of the culture keeps assuming that and keeps impressing that on us, because we use words that embrace us all, the nation, the country, America. I am, from time to time, accused of castigating America because I've castigated Reagan or Clinton or somebody. And something, you mean they are America? You mean Congress is America? You mean the President? You mean the Supreme Court? You mean they are America? This failure to recognize class divisions in this country, goes way, way back. And of course we've had class divisions in this country from the very moment that people arrived in this country, right? People didn't arrive. I remember going to school and thinking, I don't know what grade I was in then. I wouldn't like to think I was in graduate school and I was still ignorant. Although in graduate school, I was still ignorant of a lot of things. I remember thinking, the people who came here, they were the pilgrims. They were all the same. Look at the way they dressed. They all dressed the same way. They all talked the same way. I guess they were all of the same class. I guess the people who came here were all at about the same level. And somehow, in some mysterious way, soon some of them turned up very rich, and others turned up as servants. A genetic problem, you know. Who knows what? But then when I began to look more closely at colonial history, you know, than reading the Reader's Digest, I thought, some people came here to this country immediately with enormous grants of land, and other people came here with nothing, and other people came here as servants, and of course other people came here as slaves. We had a class society right from the beginning. And the period in this country before the American Revolution was not simply a period, and I remember what I got out of my education in elementary and junior high and high school, and even to a great extent in college, that whole period before the American Revolution was a period marked essentially by conflict between the colonists and England. But that wasn't so. That conflict between the colonists and England only developed really in the last 10 years before the Revolution, and last 12 years before the Revolution. But before that, the major conflicts that took place in that long period from the beginning of the 17th century to the American Revolution, the major conflicts were class conflicts, were tenants rebelling against their landlords, food riots in Boston, flour riots, the storehouses of merchants being broken into by hungry people, the governor's mansion being invaded and his wines taken out. Not a bad idea. But we don't talk about class in this country. I remember seeing a movie review in the Boston Globe, my hometown newspaper, movie review of a movie called Germinal. Some of you may know the novel by Emile Zola, Germinal, which is very heavy, class-conscious novel about miners and their struggles. That was Germinal. And the French made a movie about it. I don't think Hollywood would make a movie about it, but the French made a movie about it. The reviewer in the Boston Globe didn't like the movie. At the end of the review, they always had this designation. They still have this designation, you know, for PG, PG-13, R, Q, Y, X, you know, those things, right? And if they said, if they had R, they explained why. No. And usually if it was R, it said nudity, profanity, frontal nudity, rear nudity, some kind of nudity, and some kind of profanity, and, you know, to explain the R. And so they had, Germinal had R. And I had read the novel, and I hadn't seen the movie, but I thought, gee, I wonder what in that would produce that designation R. And the explanation was, this is an exact quote, unlike all the other things, this is a real exact quote, depiction of intense suffering and class conflict. Really? I know, you don't believe it. Well, I didn't believe it when I read it. But, you know, you have to read the newspapers with an open mind. And, yeah, there it was. I remember Bush. Do you remember Bush? Yeah, Bush. I remember Bush in his campaign against Dukakis, accusing Dukakis. Do you remember Dukakis? Yes. We in Massachusetts, we remember Dukakis. Dukakis. Bush was running against Dukakis, and Bush accused Dukakis of appealing to class hatred. This really surprised everybody in Massachusetts. I mean, we knew Dukakis. And the idea that Dukakis would appeal to class hatred was a little hard to accept. Every once in a while, you will see one politician accusing another politician of appealing to sort of class antagonism, as if this is the most terrible thing in the world. I mean, obviously, what we desperately need in this country is a party that will appeal to class antagonism. But no, we don't have, we don't yet have that. No. So we have all these designations which try to unite a class society into one a group with a common interest so that they can use words like national security, right? You know, as if, you know, well, all of our security is involved. And, I mean, they could say national securities. No, that would be more accurate. National interest. Well, I could talk about interest, you see, a different kind of interest. But when they say, oh, this is, and you see this, they, people up there in the high levels of politics have talked very sonorously about, well, if we will have to do this if it is a matter of national interest. And I can just see, you know, a whole population of the country nodding their heads, well, yes, of course, you know, as if our interest is the same, you know, as the Secretary of Defense or the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That all of this language is a great cover for the class divisions in our society, and for the economy. The economy is a good example, right? The economy is in good shape. The economy is in bad shape. What do you mean by the economy? And whose economy? Is it the economy the same for all of us? Does the Dow Jones average have the same meaning for everybody in the country? Are we all as fascinated by the ups and downs of the Dow Jones average, you know, as the people who own a million shares of Microsoft? If any of you read the novel Hard Times, there's this guy, a Dickensian character, Gradgrind is his name, and he's a teacher. What a teacher. Teacher who believes in facts, statistics, nothing but facts, you know. And his poor daughter has to live with this father, a caricature of a teacher, and sometimes I wonder, I don't like to think that he's not a caricature, but he actually represents a lot of real teachers, you know, and he's telling his daughter, you know, about how the life expectancy in this country is so-and-so. This is a statistic given by the assurance companies. His daughter says, yes, but I'm interested in my life. And he can't grasp the fact that there are individual lives. He has a student in his class who's a working-class girl who enters his class. She hears him saying that the wealth of England is 50 million pounds, and aren't we all therefore... I actually have this down here somewhere. I don't make everything up. Well, you could say, well, maybe I make it up and I write it down, and I claim that I saw it somewhere. Gradgrind says in the class, in this nation there are 50 millions of money. Isn't that a prosperous nation? And aren't you in a thriving state? And the mill girl thinks about it, and she answers, well, I don't know. I couldn't know whether it's a prosperous nation and whether I'm in a thriving state unless I know who has the money and whether any of it is mine. But she saw through this grand, well, what Kurt Vonnegut in one of his books called a grand falloon, a great big bubble which encompasses everything and therefore hides everything, and where you don't really know the reality until you puncture the bubble, you puncture the grand falloon. And that's what this mill girl was doing at this point. Because the reality is that it's a class economy in which 1% of the population has as much wealth as 95% of the population. And where, well, I this is something, I guess, you know, probably something you deal with every day when you're organizing, you know, what's happened in this country, you know, it's always been a class society. It's just gotten worse. There's always been a maldistribution of wealth, but the maldistribution of wealth has gotten worse. You know, in 1980, the ratio of the salary of a CEO to a worker, to an average worker, was 40 to 1. Now it's 240 to 1. You know, in the last 20 years, the wealth of the upper 1% has gone up by $1 trillion. You know, the top 1% had six trillion, now they have 7 trillion. All they'd have to do is to tax that extra trillion. Right? Imagine what we could do in this country with $1 trillion. $1,000 billion. I have to keep reminding myself what a trillion is. $1,000 billion, right? Of course, if we did that, they would cry. My God. No. There are all these realities that you know about the plight of children in this country and about how we compare to other countries. Now, you know, in this country, it's estimated 20 to 25% of children are below, you know, the poverty line. And if you look at the same figures for, you know, Finland and Sweden and Denmark, it's not 25%, but it's 3 or 4% of the children who are below the poverty line. If you look at the wages of the lowest 20% of the working class in the United States, the wages of the lowest 20% of people in Italy are higher than the wages of 20%, lowest 20% here in the United States. And remember, it wasn't so long ago that we thought, well, Italy is almost a third world country, right? And we are, of course, the greatest, most prosperous country in the world. I mean, but this to me is sort of the key to whatever organizing is going to go on around economic issues. And the key is that we are not a poor country. You know, that we are an immensely rich country. And if this money is being wasted, this is money is going to the wrong things and to wrong people and the wrong places. And this enormous wealth in this country could be used rationally and humanely in such a way as to solve the problems that we could see everywhere in the country if our eyes weren't simply fixed on the Dow Jones average. The problems we would see if we simply walked from one end of a city to another. And that's all you would have to do in every city in this country in order to understand that this is a class society. Because if you live in just one part of the city and stay there, you can well believe everything is fine. The economy is healthy. We're doing well. But all you have to do is walk, really take a long walk. Sometimes it's a short walk from one end of the city to another. And then is it any wonder that people in New York City have to put 5 locks on their doors? If you walk from Harlem down to Fifth Avenue and see the way people live in one place and see where people live another. So, I mean, these are the realities, and this is the issue. It's not a problem of the last 10 or 15 years, even though things have gotten worse, and therefore perhaps because they've gotten worse create a better opportunity to point it out. But it's a long-standing problem. It's a problem that goes way back, the maldistribution of wealth in this country. It's not just a problem that begins solved by the passage of this law and that law. It's a problem that has to be solved by a very sweeping set of changes in the economic and social structure of the country. Pope John Paul, whom I like to quote, you know, we don't have many allies in those higher circles. And so when you get a real good one, you like to make use of it. Pope John Paul, this did not appear in an American newspaper. It appeared in an Italian newspaper, La Stampa, which I read every day, of course. And an interview in La Stampa with John Paul, and he said, well, you want to understand why there are so many communists around the world and socialism and Marxists and this and that? He says, the answer is simple. The answer is, and these are the words he used, savage, unbridled capitalism. Oh, yes. Yeah, that's my Pope. Savage, unbridled capitalism. I would never dare say a thing like that. So, I mean, those are the realities, and then we're faced with a question of what do we do about them. But it's important to keep those realities in mind and to keep people informed of those realities, because it's interesting, even people who are not doing well themselves can, if they keep reading the media and listening to political speeches, can believe that they're living better than they are living. You know, the people are struggling, and they read, oh, the economy is healthy. Well, I mean, who would dare go out in the street and tell people the economy is not healthy, you know, when everybody knows it's healthy except you, you see. So therefore it's important for the facts and the reality to be kept alive, to give the lie to this notion that we're all doing well, you know, in this very rich country. And very often, you know, just giving people information is the push that starts people off to thinking about what they will do. Some of you may know Ignacio Silone's novel, Fontamara, but it's a novel that he wrote about the Mussolini period in Italy and about peasants under Mussolini and their what they went through and the repression against them. And in the novel, this little group of dissenters, and of course it was dangerous to dissent under Mussolini, this little group of dissenters puts out an underground newspaper. And in this underground newspaper, all they do is give information, tell people things that they haven't heard about. And they in this newspaper, they will just give bits of news. So-and-so had his farm taken away from him the other day. So-and-so's child died of sickness because no doctor available. You know, so-and-so was arrested by the police. Just listing those facts, and then they would say, "Che fare? What shall we do? What shall we do?" They wouldn't tell people what to do. They'd just give them the information, and they'd ask, "What shall we do?" And people would get together, and they'd begin to talk about what they might do about these things. And we have, you know, promises have been made. It's very easy to make promises, but the people who make promises very often have to be called to account for these promises. It's very easy to pass the 14th Amendment, to promise racial equality, and not to deliver on it. But at a certain point, the demand was made by black people in this country that they had to deliver on it. And it was important to keep the promise in mind, even though the promise had been broken again and again. And so promises have been made in this country about economic justice. The promise of the Declaration of Independence. Yeah. That this is what governments are set up for. Governments are set up to ensure certain rights, and the equal right of all of us to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And how can you have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness unless you have sort of basic biologic needs that people require in order to live, a good health and a good home and food and work? The promise of course, the Declaration of Independence is not a legal document. No. Constitution is a legal document. The Declaration of Independence is just a promise. But it's a promise that deserves to be held up and to be looked upon as a model for something that we're trying to achieve. And from various points in American history, promises have been made. FDR, Franklin D. Roosevelt, in World War II, in 1944, talked about an economic bill of rights. Very specifically, about, you know, the right to housing and jobs and health and so on. Really marvelous. Of course, nothing happened to it. It was never fulfilled. It was done, you might say, in the heat of war, of a war. Wars very often will bring out great rhetoric, which is not then fulfilled. But the rhetoric should not be forgotten. The Economic Bill of Rights should not be forgotten. And then there's And there were the words of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which all the nations signed after World War II, including the United States, after a while. And the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and, you know, Articles 24, 25, 23, 26, talks about every human being on earth deserves a place to live, a decent place to live, deserves a right to a living wage, deserves health care, people... need to be given equal pay for equal work. And that's the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So there are these words, you know, there are these promises which have not been fulfilled by the economic policies of this country over, you know, a long period of time. And if you talk about fulfilling these promises, if you talk about the government guaranteeing full employment, And some of you may know that in 1946, again perhaps in the emotions generated by World War II, Congress passed the Full Employment Act. And the Full Employment Act talks about the government guaranteeing work. Now, there's a basis, right, for something being done to make sure that people who want to work will have work. You don't simply throw people off the welfare rolls and say, private enterprise will take care of you in the way that private enterprise has always taken care of people, you see. And when you begin talking about yes, this is what the government should do, and the government should stop giving 250, now 260, maybe $270 billion to the military and use that money for human needs, you know. The government should guarantee health care the way they do in Canada and Sweden and other countries in the world where you just don't have to think about filling out forms or doing this or that. You just go and take care of your problem. You know, I spent some time in Italy and I got sick and, you know, there was no money involved. It's wonderful to be in a society where you can get basic things and not think about money and think that every human being deserves this. Well, if you begin to talk about these things, then some people will say, oh, you want big government. Remember the big government? And you're supposed to shrink back in your seat at that point. Me? Did I say something? Did I say big government? It's a dirty thing to say. Big government. And I remember how Clinton faded back, you know, and, you know, when people accused him of, no. And then, remember Clinton's famous remark, the era of big government is over. Right? What hypocrisy. Really? The era of big government is over. Have we ever had a bigger government? I mean, have we ever not had big government in this country? We've always had big government. There's never been an era of big government. Our whole history is a history of big government. That's what the Founding Fathers did. They established big government. And they established it for a very definite reason, because big government would serve the purposes of the merchants and the slaveholders and the bondholders and the land speculators. They wanted big government. And all through the 19th century, the corporate powers used big government to give the railroads 100 million acres of land free, to pass tariffs for the manufacturers and subsidies for the merchant marine. They loved big government. And only in the 20th century, when, for the first time, under the impetus of the socialist movement and the IWW and the labor struggles of the late 19th and early 20th century, when the government began to react to that, we began to get reform legislation, and in the 30s with the great labor movement and the turmoil over the country, all over the country, that we began to get the New Deal legislation on housing and minimum wages, only then did the cry go up, oh, big government, the welfare state, as if the state had not been a welfare state all through its history, but welfare, of course, for the corporations and not for ordinary people. I think we have to be prepared to deal with that, you know, that question. And by the way, World War II, almost everything I say is by the way. I have nothing real to say. It's just all these, you know, World War II, we had big government. When we have to win a war, we have very big government. We have to do something that requires mobilization of the resources of the country to win a war. Then we get big government, and nobody complains. Nobody says, let's turn the war over to private enterprise, you see. Let Dunkin' Donuts take care of, you know. Between Exxon and Dunkin' Donuts, they will take care of the problem. Yeah, no. No. Big government is okay. We had full employment during the war. We put 20 million people to work during the war in various jobs, military and civilian. And wages would you know, fairly decent, better than they had been. The country came out of depression as a result of big government during World War II. So what the society is willing to do in time of war, it should be willing to do in time of peace. And these things, that history, should not be forgotten. I mean, all this history is important, I think, for dealing with the objections that people make. And you need that history, because if you don't have that history, it's as if you were born yesterday. And if you were born yesterday, people can tell you anything. And you have no way of checking up on it. And it's only with history that you have a way of checking up on the things that people tell you. What else is there to say? That obviously we have a lot to do. We have a lot of organizing to do. We shouldn't despair, because people have despaired all through the ages, you know, but they've gone through all sorts of periods. Think of the 1950s, and people was walking around gloomy in the 1950s saying, we'll know, nothing will ever happen in this country. And then come the 60s, and you get a civil rights movement and an anti-war movement and a women's movement and a gay movement and an environmental movement, right? Disabled persons movement and so on. And you know, the indignation of people builds up under the surface. Well, we've seen this happen in other countries, right? I mean, surprises take place in other countries. Suddenly, the Berlin Wall comes down. Suddenly, the Franco dictatorship is gone. Suddenly, you know, a tyranny is toppled. How come? Because things were happening beneath the surface. People were organizing quietly, and you couldn't tell what was going on. And then at a certain point in time, they broke through, and remarkable changes come, and everybody is surprised. So you have to persist and in the faith, in the hope, not the certainty, but the possibility. Probability? I don't know. Somewhere between possibility. Is there something between possibility and probability? But somehow yes, if you persist, something good will happen. You don't know when. You don't even know if, but you know that in the meantime, you will, life will be more meaningful. Well, all of you know this. You've been involved. And you know that life becomes meaningful when you work with other people for something good. I want to end by reading a poem written by a friend of mine. I only read poems written by friends of mine. Daniel Berrigan. And he wrote this after a friend of his who was an activist for homeless people in Washington, D.C., Mitch Snyder. Some of you may remember him. A wonderful man, and he died tragically in Washington. Dan Berrigan wrote this poem in loving memory, Mitchell Snyder. Some stood up once and sat down. Some walked a mile and walked away. Some stood up twice, then sat down. I've had it, they said. Some walked 2 miles, then walked away. It's too much, they cried. Some stood and stood and stood. They were taken for fools. They were taken for being taken in. Some walked and walked and walked. They walked the earth. They walked the waters. They walked the air. Why do you stand, they were asked, and why do you walk? Because of the children, they said, and because of the heart and because of the bread. Because the cause is the heart's beat and the children born and the risen bread. So, thank you. So, it's your turn.
And that was historian Howard Zinn speaking on A Working Class Citizen's Economic Bill of Rights. The talk was originally given in Denver, Colorado in 1998.
Seen all of us first separated, hurt apart and afraid, hungry for the union, so we kept on singing and working, fighting till we got it. It's the big union song, I guess I hear. Oh. battles. I'll add it up when I saw what we got now. Union songs, union battles. I'll add it up when I saw what we got now.
There have been some dramatic developments on the Frankenfood front, both locally and nationally, during the past month. Novartis, the world's largest biotech company, announced that it would remove all GMOs from its food products, though it would continue to sell GMO seeds. It has also broken ranks with biotech conglomerates Monsanto and DuPont over their $50 million ad blitz to promote ag biotech. A recent advertisement appeared in the New York Times as part of the corporate PR plan. It shows a handsome farmer standing tall with a caption, "This farmer is going to feed the world using biotechnology." Novartis director challenged those assertions. He said, quote, "If anyone tells you that GM is going to feed the world, tell them that it is not. To feed the world takes political and financial will. It's not about production and distribution." Close quote. And a new study released earlier this week by Iowa State University validated the work of John Losey of Cornell University. It found that pollen from genetically engineered Bt corn plants was deadly to monarch butterfly larvae. At least 8 studies are currently in process as a result of Losey's early work. Assemblyman Marty Luster has withdrawn his support of the roundtable debate on a proposed New York State GMO crop moratorium that was scheduled to take place in Ithaca on September 14th. Tony Del Plato of the Ithaca Area Safe Food Campaign, which was co-sponsoring the roundtable, said that Luster accused him of hijacking the roundtable and trying to create a political rally on September 14th. The SFC was to bring 2 representatives speaking on behalf of a moratorium. Assemblyman Luster was to get 2 people from Cornell to speak against the moratorium. Del Plato said he was surprised by Luster's withdrawal. He said, "My political agenda has been on the table since our first meeting last spring. Support for legislation supporting a moratorium on the production and marketing of all genetically modified foods, the establishment of independent scientific research and protocols, labeling and full liability coverage for biopollution and damages to other farmers and gardeners. Our health depends upon the well-being of other living communities, including animals, insects, and soil microorganisms. These communities need to be covered by liability as well. That is the agenda for the Ithaca Area Safe Food Campaign, Organic Consumers Association." The Safe Food Campaign will still present its 2 speakers. The public is invited to hear a talk by Mary Howell Martins and Klaus Martins entitled "Organic Farming and Biotechnology." The Martins farm 1,100 acres of certified organic crops in Penyan, New York, including corn, soybeans, small grains, and processing vegetables. Mary Howell Martins teaches plant structure and function at the Finger Lakes Community College and serves on the USDA Advisory Committee on Agricultural Biotechnology. Klaus is a nominee for the National Organic Standards Board. The talk will take place on Thursday, September 14th, Thursday at 7 p.m. at the Women's Community Building, located at the corner of Seneca and Cayuga Streets in Ithaca. And Midnight Gardeners have been at it again. On Friday, August 25th, anti-biotech direct actionists calling themselves Los Niños del Maíz carried out actions at the University of California, San Diego, UCSD. The activists destroyed 1 acre of genetically modified maize and entered and destroyed the contents of 4 greenhouses containing rice, maize, Arabidopsis, tomatoes, tobacco, and other GE life forms. The activists also spray-painted messages on the greenhouses and mixed up paper bags that were being used to collect maize in the field. A communique released by the activists said, quote, "Maize, the 3rd most important food crop in terms of production, exemplifies the loss of biodiversity on Earth. Today, a measly 80 plant crops provide 90% of the world's food from plants, out of tens of thousands of significantly edible plants available. Biodiversity is up for sale. Private ownership violates the very nature of community rights, and in the case of genetic resources, genetic engineering limits access to collective heritage to only a few, unquote. Since November 1998, there have been roughly 38 anti-genetic direct actions in North America, and the movement shows no signs of slowing. The direct actionists maintain that biotechnology is completely unnecessary and is being developed at the expense of human and ecological health solely to increase the profits of large multinational corporations. BIO, the advocacy group for the biotechnology industry, is scheduled to meet in San Diego next June. Los Niños del Maíz, the children of the corn, said they are preparing a welcome.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. You can also download shows you may have missed or get more info on the topics covered. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers.